Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
The Bob Seska Show.
Bob Seska.
Today's Rachel Maddow Show Award for Headline Excellence goes to Bob Seska.
The Bob Seska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, November 17, 2021, and this is the interview edition of the Bob Seska Show on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, how you doing? My name is Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hello. Day 302 of the Biden-Harris administration, 355 days until the 22 midterms. Please follow me on Instagram at TheBobSeska and on Twitter at BobSeska_go. Okie dokie, with Thanksgiving a week away, I thought we'd connect today with the great Dr. Erwin Redlener and accost him with our questions about COVID, what we can expect in the coming months, why we are where we are, and of course, how best to navigate the holidays with the pandemic still scorching the earth. And in case you don't know, Dr. Redlener is a pediatrician. He's the director of the Pandemic Resource and Response Initiative, and he's the senior research scholar for the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University's Earth Institute. You know, my old jobs. You might have also heard Dr. Redlener every Thursday on the Stephanie Miller Show, where he's known as Dr. Doom. I have a giant stack of questions right here of my own for Dr. Redlener, as well as questions from our subscribers on Patreon at patreon.com/Bob Seska Show. So let's jump in with the inimitable Dr. Erwin Redlener. Thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Redlener. I mean, your work this past couple of years has been so immense, so invaluable for so many people. And, you know, Stephanie Miller's got a gigantic audience. And for you two to team up and to confront the pandemic the way you have is just an incredible public service. I mean, the information alone, just in those Thursday segments, has been worth its weight in gold. So we, of course, we all thank you for that.
Thanks for that. So,
I mean, did you ever?
She's great to speak to. She's just great to speak to.
she really is. Yeah. She's one of the best. I mean, did you ever think a pandemic would be as badly botched as it was under the previous guy? I mean, did you ever think that that was actually going to happen in your lifetime, in your career?
Yes, I did.
Really? What gave you that impression? What gave you that indication that eventually we were going to get nailed?
You know, the older I've gotten, the more concerned I've been that the country, the world, a lot of the systems that keep us together and healthy and moving forward are not as durable as I might have hoped years ago. And I feel like there's been a longstanding. Are we recording? But I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. We're underway.
Oh, I'm sorry. So, okay.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I feel like there's been a longstanding deterioration of how we're able to function. I wrote a book in 2006 called Americans at Risk.
Yes.
And I was talking about, and, you know, why we're not prepared for mega disasters and what we can do now was the subtitle. Mm-hmm. And I went through a bunch of scenarios, including, now this is 2006, a scenario that had the emergence of a very deadly pandemic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I talked about this whole chapter on infrastructure deterioration in the country and so on. And I've just not seen that much really focused effort to either prevent or be prepared for a pandemic or to fix the infrastructure until we, just now we're getting this big trillion-dollar infrastructure bill.
Yeah.
But the general point that I'm trying to make here is that my cynicism has not improved over time in a way.
I know what you mean.
I don't know what, you remember when JFK said we're going to get to the moon in basically a decade.
Yeah.
Put a man on the moon is what the point was, mm-hmm. a human being on the moon, and then return that person or persons back to the earth. And I think at my age at that point, I was extremely impressionable, and I was just absolutely, blown away by that accomplishment. I think in some ways, many of us of my generation were affected very positively by the fact that, yeah, we could do big things. And there's been a lot of disappointments since then that I've experienced. And like I say, and I wasn't the only one that talked about the potential pandemics. And in fact, I've been researching for an article I'm going to be writing on were there warnings that we ignored, mm-hmm. About a potential pandemic. And seems that there was a bunch of us who kept talking about these things that we needed to be better prepared for. In the case of after Hurricane Katrina, which devastated the Gulf, there was a lot of writing and people talking about a potential pandemic, to the point where a lot of state and city plans getting ready for a pandemic were written. There were federal plans and an amazing amount of work being done and documented. And then lo and behold, it disappeared onto these, shelves with cobwebs. And all of a sudden we find ourselves in late 2019 and into 2020 experiencing A, what people were warning about, and B, what we had made plans for so many years ago, and they were completely missing in action, those plans.
Yeah.
And here we are facing something like no one ever heard of this before. And it's, I don't know what to make of that exactly, Bob, or what you might make of it, but it really knocked the crap out of me. I'm thinking, what the hell? We, didn't we used to be able to do things?
God.
Anyway, that's
I'm so with you. I'm on the exact same track. My angle, obviously, since I'm not an expert in the field, my angle is more about people in general. But it's the same conclusion. We just can't do big things anymore. And it's to the point now where I find myself becoming very disillusioned and very depressed over that sad fact. And that, leads us into the fact that we're facing an endemic COVID moving forward, we're just gonna move on and pretend like it's not even there.
Because the problem, Bob, to your point, is that if we don't like the fact that we're going to be facing what's going to amount to an endemic situation, the mm-hmm. question is, what could we do to avoid it? What could we have done to avoid it? And the basic thing was that we could have done research, and number one, which we did do quite a bit of. But then where we missed out was taking the results of the research, which is these very effective vaccines, and made sure they were available around the world, not just in the U.S. And we would have had a shot at eradicating the thing. But we're pathetically far behind, and we're suffering from that.
Why was COVID so rampant, whereas maybe something like SARS or Ebola was more or less controlled at an early stage before it got to the point that we're experiencing now with COVID? Why did it hit us so hard this time?
Right. Well, first of all, let's talk about Ebola for a minute. Ebola is a horribly lethal disease. It would just kill people dramatically and suddenly and rapidly. And the virus destroyed the hosts that it was infecting. So the hosts are not able to infect others so readily. Mm-hmm. And this one, we have lots, we have millions and millions of people around the world who are sick, but survive, and they survive as transmitters of the virus. And that was just not the case with Ebola. It was too lethal to end up being a serious threat of a global pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there are other features about viruses that have, you know, all different kinds of characteristics that may make them more lethal or less lethal and so on. But, you know, this illness, this SARS-CoV-2 virus, which caused the COVID-19 worldwide pandemic, mm-hmm. satisfied the criteria for a pandemic. Number one, it was a brand new virus. So we didn't have previous history of exposure. So we didn't really have the immunologic history to be able to fend it off without developing a vaccine. And second of all, it is able to be transmitted from person to person. And third of all, it was lethal. And fourth of all, it was able to transcend international barriers, which are all these are the criteria for the World Health Organization to declare this a pandemic. Mm-hmm. And this was in some ways the perfect vector to become and to fulfill the definition of a pandemic. So it was thriving thriving in all parts of the world. I don't think there's a country on earth right now that has not had any presence of this virus. Mm-hmm. So this was a rough one. And I wish I could say, you know, it's the worst one prior to this, of course, was the Spanish flu in 1918.
Yeah.
Which killed between 50 million and 100 million people worldwide, killed 675,000 Americans at a time when our population was a fraction of what we have today. Mm-hmm. And but the problem is, I'm not sure it's going to be another 100 years before we see a very lethal pandemic.
Yeah.
You know, would I be shocked if we saw another one in a decade? No, I would not. And, you know, we just have to be better prepared. Mm-hmm. To deal with these as they inevitably come up.
Sometimes I wonder, Doctor, whether the response by everyday Americans would have been more careful if the virus itself had been more shockingly destructive. Like if it had featured some sort of hemorrhagic aspect to it, like if you started bleeding from the eyeballs or something like that, would that shock people into being more careful? Whereas early on with COVID, the word from certainly the White House was, don't worry about it. It's just like the flu. And yeah. Of course we see the consequences of that certainly being on a ventilator, gasping for breath wasn't quite enough to stir people into that kind of action. I mean, if there is any,
I'm thinking too of smallpox, where your whole body would break out these horrible, ugly blisters, but mm-hmm. the eyeball bleeding. I like that, Bob. You're a man with imagination, and I have to appreciate that. But I'm mulling over that thought, and I actually agree with you. In many ways, it could have been a very different scenario mm-hmm. if people had some very, very visible signs and symptoms of having this disease. But you would think the high fatality rates that we're having and people getting really sick would have been enough. And it's a little, it's kind of, you know, don't you think a little pathetic that we've been through all this, you know, we have approximately 675,000 people now, Americans only, who have died. Mm-hmm. And if we don't change our ways, if things don't get better, we could end up in 6-7 months from now hitting that million fatality mark, which would be, you know, just another number, but it's certainly a frightening one.
Can you explain why the CDC eases up on protocols when the numbers are low? To once and for all smother the virus when it's at its weakest. Why aren't we doing that? Does that make any sense to you?
It doesn't make sense, but I completely understand what you're saying. And I think it's a damn shame in a way. If you think about it, mm-hmm. we're kind of addicted to this daily toll here. You know, we're tracking everything as much as possible, which includes the case reports in specific states and regions, the case reports by age. We're tracking hospitalization rates. We're tracking fatality rates. And we're tracking, you know, who gets so-called long COVID or symptoms long beyond their acute illness. But what happens now is, which one of the things that is surprising to me is that we're very reactive to the day-to-day data. And it's, this is a case of, you know, in some ways, national and professional wishful thinking. You know, oh my God, the numbers are down for the last few weeks. I guess we should start thinking that maybe we've gotten this thing under control.
Yeah.
You know, one of the strangest things I heard in the last few weeks was the former FDA commissioner himself, Scott Gottlieb, who's a pretty, you know, respected physician. He had he ran the FDA. And he said just a few weeks ago that by January, I think he said January 4th, we should pretty much have this COVID thing under control. And I almost fell off my chair.
Yeah.
What the hell are you freaking talking about? Are you kidding? And I called Dr. Fauci and I said, what do you make of this? Because that morning is when Gottlieb had made that statement. I think it was on ABC or something. And Fauci totally agreed with me. It's a preposterously, inappropriately optimistic conclusion to draw, because we're having a little bit of a downturn at that point. Mm. And now we're having an uptick after he said that. So, this brings up this other point. You know, there's a lot of so-called modelers, Bob, you know, these people at epidemiologists are saying, here's where we are now, here's what we think, knowing the characteristics of the illness, and this is what I predict will be happening at some point in the future. That hardly ever turns out to be accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at a time like this, when it seems that we are more and more uncertain about where this is going, you know, you're on very, very thin ice by making a very specific prediction about where we are with COVID. Of course, everybody wants to know. Everybody in the profession, the general public, my family, when is this going to be over is the question. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have to see. We're still tracking.
Yeah. Well, I've given up on it being over. I mean, I feel like we just, going back to our original point of conversation, Doctor, we just can't do it. We're incapable of doing it. Not enough of us give a shit. And that's the biggest problem. And then, you know, when you see numbers really low, like after the first vaccine rollout last spring, seems to me as if that's when we should have clobbered it. That's when masking should have been doubled, should have been more protocols adhered to at that point in time. Just to kill it right there when the numbers were low is so tantalizing. And that's when we relaxed everything, you know?
You know, if only some higher power could say, okay, here's what we're dealing with. And listen, by next week, we need every single freaking human being vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been lovely. We would have squelched it. In fact, if we still think that if we could get up to that magic, you know, 80, 85% number of everybody being vaccinated, we might reach that magic herd immunity number where it would just kind of stop the virus in its tracks. We're nowhere near that.
Yeah,
we're pathetically far from that. Why are we far from that? We know it'd be interesting. You and I should go on a tour of these red states where these people believe still that if they get vaccinated, they're inserting it. Somebody's inserting a chip into their body,
right?
Or they become magnetic, or this is all a spoof or a conspiracy that was developed by the White House and the Biden administration. Who the hell knows what else people are believing? Oh, you know, horse parasite medication will stop it in its tracks.
Amazing.
I mean, the resistance among Americans, and actually many other places in Europe too, but the resistance among Americans to getting vaccinated is startling, and we don't have the mechanism really to enforce things in a timely manner, like enforce things like mandatory vaccines.
In fact, you know what? I'm already referring to the next wave doctor, as the complacency wave. I think that's what we're facing next. Where it's an upswing based on complacency. And, you know, one thing I've been trying to figure out is the reopening of travel from Europe, right when Europe is spiking with a, I think WHO is forecasting 500,000 dead this coming winter. What am I missing?
Well, the only thing that I would say about this, and I totally agree with your, you know, raised eyebrows at this, because I had the same feeling, but it's not just open doors. It's open doors, but you've got to be able to prove that you have been fully vaccinated. Mm-hmm. There's going to be rules on the airplanes when you come in. There's going to be testing requirements.
Okay.
So there are safeguards in effect, but the most important one is if you're fully vaccinated, that is what you need to kind of get a ticket into the U.S. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably okay. And don't forget, the longer we postpone people and business coming to the country, the longer we're going to postpone the full economic recovery that we certainly need. And so it's a complicated, multifaceted challenge, but I think that's where we are.
Should we be looking at the booster rate more than the original vaccination rate to determine where we're headed? In other words, it seems like the vaccinations from, say, the early adopters in the spring and summer are precipitously wearing off. Those vaccines are wearing off at this point, indicating that the booster rate should maybe be the central focus now to make up for that.
Yeah, so let's talk about boosters a bit. So, my wife and I we got our second shot. She got Pfizer, I got Moderna. Mm. We both got them on February 4th.
Yeah.
I remember that because that's actually her birthday. That's what I did for her birthday. We're going to go out to dinner. But I said, hey, you know what? Let's get our second shot.
Hey, you know what? What better gift is that, even though it's free?
And I'm sure she's going to start talking to me again soon. Any day now. So expecting her to answer me. But I think that the thing of it is, so we found out, mostly through studies that are coming out of Israel and some other places, but that over time, the immunity that you get from the vaccine begins to wear off. And around 6 months is where we start to see a drop in the levels of the antibodies that have been produced as a result of your getting vaccinated. Mm. At that point, it was felt that if we got a third booster, if we got a third shot or a booster shot, what would that do to our antibody level? And it turns out it pushed it way back up, like as if it was a few weeks after your initial series. So the boosters have been shown to be a very effective way of getting us back in a situation where we have better antibody protection. Yeah. Now, I want to say this as a side note, Bob, because this is a little unfortunate, but if you went to your doctor and said, I'd like to get an antibody test to see how I'm doing in terms of protection, the doctor will get the test. They'll come back with a number. Let's say it's 50 units of whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And say, well, doc, is 50 good enough to protect me? Because it was 500 when I first got the shots. The doctor has to say, I have no idea. We don't know how much antibody is actually necessary to keep you protected. So we're flying in the dark a bit here. And the other thing is, even if your antibodies are low, there's other parts of the immune system, something called T cells and B cells, among other things, that you can't easily measure. And so all I'm saying is that we got a lot of unknowns here. However, there's no question that the booster shot is a very important tool in our arrow, in our quiver here, mm-hmm. that people who are vaccinated should really get. And you're going to see in the next couple of days that the federal government is going to go along with what a lot of states are doing now, which is saying that if you're 18 or over, regardless of whether you have any kind of risk factors or not, you should get a booster shot. All of that said, yes, everybody's going to be getting boosters. But the problem is, if I might elaborate here just a little bit,
sure,
is not the people who have already gotten vaccinated. Those people are going to be relatively easy to convince they need a booster shot. You know, you had two shots, the immunity is waning, get a booster. Okay. It's the people who didn't get even the first shots that I'm much more worried about. And we could boost everybody who's already gotten vaccinated, but we're still going to be left with many millions of people who are the vaccine hesitant or the hardcore resistors or whatever. So one thing I'm a little concerned about is the national priority going to be on boosting, or is it going to continue to be getting people their first shots? And I think the latter is critically important. And the failure to get people the first couple of shots is what's really going to keep us from getting control over the pandemic anytime soon.
Do you know the extent of, let's just confine it to the United States, Americans who have a phobia of getting injections or getting blood draws? They're afraid of needles. And I'm not saying that to poke fun of them or anything like that. I wonder if that's also a major factor here that isn't really being discussed. I mean, a lot of people say they don't want to get the vaccine. They certainly don't want to get the booster when that comes around. And I'm wondering if that's driving it, just the basic phobia of having the shot.
Well, Bob, I think that's a really interesting question. And of all the data that's out there about the reasons that people don't get shots, they're hesitant, they're worried about side effects, or they're in the crazy zone and they think that somebody's going to make them magnetic with the shots, or it's a political conspiracy. Though there's a lot of data about that, but I've actually never seen a report about these. There are people who are very wary of getting anything done. They faint at the sight of blood and whatever, and this is not to make fun of them at all or belittle them. It's basically to say, that is potentially an issue, but I don't think it's actually been explored, but a very interesting one.
But at the same time, I'm seeing a lot of kids with smiles on their faces getting the vaccine, and that's always impressive. When I see the kids bravely going in and doing it, that's always something that puts a smile on my face at the very least. Is there any new information on how long natural immunity from having COVID will last? I mean, I've read anywhere from a week to a year to a big question mark. It's a pretty big gap there. Are experts starting to zero in on more specific numbers?
Well, there's certainly data being collected. And don't forget, since it's a new virus, the only way really to tell whether natural immunity from actually having had the disease is going to last 4 months, 6 months, or a year and a half is to follow people for that long.
Yeah.
And, you know, we just haven't had enough of it around to make that determination. So a big I don't know is still appropriate here. Yeah. And then the question has come up, if you have had the disease, do you need to get vaccinated? And the answer right now is yes, you should. Mm-hmm. You still need to get vaccinated. But there's controversy about what's called the durability of the immune response following a vaccine versus following the disease, and still an unanswered question. And that's something I think we will get more answers on soon. But I think the preponderance of evidence, not all of it, suggests that the vaccine provides a longer lasting immunity.
Have we started to look at the health and quality of life ramifications of COVID becoming endemic? Are there studies that are being developed along those lines?
You mean Like what is change?
What is life going to be like here in the United States in particular when it's endemic? There's nothing really we can do about it at that point. And it's just something that becomes a fact of life, however terrible, however deadly. It seems like with an endemic situation, seems like we basically are all vulnerable on a long enough timeline. It's eventually going to hit all of us at some point. Has there been any forecasts along those lines? Like, what is our life going to be like here? What sorts of things can we expect with COVID being endemic?
Well, let's start with this. And that's a very, very interesting question. But let's start with this. The COVID pandemic has already altered life as we know it a lot.
Oh,
you know the analogy of boiling a frog. You know, and you put a frog in cold water and you turn up the heat, and he'll eventually die in there. But he'll tolerate an awful lot of heat because if you're going up slowly versus throwing somebody in a fire or whatever. And anyway, it's kind of a crazy analogy, and I'd like to retract it, but. You know, this is radio. It's a permanent record now. So, but let me say this. What has happened is in ways that we haven't necessarily focused on. A lot has changed. How we work, where we work, what the workplace is like, what we need to do to eat dinner in a restaurant, or go to a sporting event or a theater. Much of our life has changed because during the acute phases of this, we're insisting on separation and avoiding crowding, wearing masks indoors, learning remotely, working remotely, really reducing travel. If you add up all of those things which have changed, and then you say, which you just did very appropriately as well, what happens if it becomes endemic and it's just a permanent part of life? Well, first of all, I would assume, you know, right now, even as we're significantly better than we were a year ago, or even in September of this year, we're still having, as we speak, between 1,000 and 1,300 fatalities every single day from COVID.
Incredible.
And, you know, that's extraordinary. And I think at some point, yes, we might reach some level of success, even though the virus might still be with us. It's inevitably going to be with us for a while. But hopefully those fatality rates should be way, way down. Mm-hmm. And before we can sort of declare a truce, if not a victory, over COVID. And that's what we're dealing with. I think there are going to be some things that are going to be different permanently. I don't think we're going to see life as it was, because during seasons when we're getting high rates of whether it's influenza or COVID, we're going to see people wearing masks indoors. We're going to see people still being asked to do physical separating, social distancing, and so on. I think those are going to be facts of life, in addition to getting regular booster shots that are going to keep the majority of us safe. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you this, Bob, and I think this is something people ought to understand. If you decide you're not going to get vaccinated, you put yourself at a risk that's between 10 and 30 times higher.
Wow.
Than for people who are vaccinated, a risk of dying. Mm. And if you want to live like that, you know, good luck to you. But the problem is that almost all of us, like you said, are ultimately going to get some form of COVID. If you've been vaccinated, the chances are overwhelming you'll get a mild case, a breakthrough case that's not going to put you in a hospital or kill you.
Well, it seems like a small minority are kind of wagging the dog at this point, and it's as you know, immensely frustrating. And you know, I wanted to get to some listener questions here. I've got a whole variety. Oh my God, I've got so many questions here for you. But starting off here, let's start with Jen Hardy, who asks. And some of them are referring to you as Dr. Doom. So if I accidentally say Dr. Doom, that's only because it's on the page. Well, so please ask Dr. Doom how we navigate family who aren't vaccinated. Obviously, lots of people are thinking about the holidays. Do you spend time with them or do you decline? What are your recommendations along those lines, if any?
Here's what I recommend. Not everybody's going to feel like doing this, but I think this is what is appropriate. You say to a loved one, and I mean that, a loved one, that we love to see you. We love your grandchildren to see you, but we're going to wait until you get vaccinated. If you're not vaccinated, it's taking a risk that for our children, grandchildren, and ourselves for getting a breakthrough. That's a risk for you. So as soon as you get vaccinated, we'll be happy for all of us to get together. Mm-hmm. But until you get vaccinated, it's just not going to happen. That could be said nicely, nicer than I just said it. But because the fact is, you know, it's like there are a lot of people who are facing this within their own families. I have a situation in my own family that is beyond frustrating, but it's something that we're trying to deal with. And somebody who's important to our kids and our grandchildren, and these people have always been part of our family activities, but not now.
Yeah.
Not until they get vaccinated.
Meantime, Joe and Jenny Berman ask, have we truly squandered, and we kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, Doctor, have we truly squandered our opportunity to actually eradicate the virus? Is that door closed or closing behind us?
You know, this is such a rapidly spreading and mutating virus, Bob, that it'd be hard to say that we have totally closed the door on this. But I think the thing that keeps the door closed on trying to really solve it as a, you know, just really ending it globally, is the fact that there are so many countries, really continents around the world, like Africa and Southeast Asia, where the vaccination rates are very, very low, like, you know, 5% of the population being vaccinated. Yeah. Those are places where there's a festering of the virus and an easy development of mutations and variants that inevitably will escape those boundaries. The virus has never heard of boundaries. So it's inevitably going to get to us. So it's really true. It sounds like a cliche, but we're not going to conquer this until it's conquered everywhere. In other words, we may get a temporary boost or relief if, you know, your state, your city has very low numbers. But because there's so much travel and so much communication among people and movement among people, we're really far from getting to a place where it could be eradicated from the planet.
Okay, moving on. Jimmy Driscoll asks, does being vaccinated and boosted cut down on my chances of spreading COVID if I still somehow caught the virus?
So presumably you're going to have a much lower viral load, meaning how much virus is actually in your nose and throat. Mm-hmm. And your chances of spreading it are less than somebody who's got a flagrant case, not mitigated by having been vaccinated. And that's the case. But we should remember that the vaccines do not eliminate you getting the infection. They simply massively reduce the chance of you getting very sick, going to an ICU or dying from the disease.
Okay, so Jerry Hillman asks, can the mRNA technology that was used to produce the COVID vaccine be used for other types of viruses, such as the ones that cause the common cold?
Yes, you know, this mRNA technology, which is what Pfizer and Moderna used, is a very powerful tool for rapidly developing new vaccines. And I think we're going to see a lot of progress made with other diseases using this technology. It's a really big deal. And it's a good question.
Okay. Jason Albrecht asks, I would like to know what the doctor's thoughts are on the new Israeli study saying the vaccine is not required if you have had COVID-19. I haven't heard of that study myself, but I don't know if you have any insight on that, Doctor.
I have, you know, and actually, Israel is one of the places from which there's been, you know, not so much controversy, but different kinds of data, different studies showing different results. And I think this question of the immunity conferred by the vaccine or the disease or the combination of the two, having a disease and then also getting vaccinated, I don't think we're at the end of the discussion about this. And there's a lot of data that's going to have to be digested now as we try to figure this out. Yeah. But it's still a work in progress, Jason.
Amy Clark asks an interesting question here. Is there reason to believe that the virus will gradually mutate to become weaker and therefore less scary?
Well, if it becomes weaker, that means weaker in the sense that it's not transmissible as much as the original strains. Yes, that would be a big deal. But unfortunately, this is probably the time to say it can also become mutated to the point where it is more resistant to the vaccines. And that would be a real problem. And there's recently been a public health expert who's predicting that there's some chance that we'll get a vaccine-resistant strain, which would be unthinkably horrendous if that were to happen. Yeah. Hopefully it won't.
My God, yeah. Ted the Cat asks, because there are so many idiots in America, see previous conversation between me and Dr. Redliner, what is the next variant that is of interest to the CDC?
Right, so Delta Plus, which is we're somewhere between 6 and 8% of the new cases of the virus in the United Kingdom, and there's been a few cases here. It's thought to be 10% more transmissible, but not necessarily more lethal or making people sicker, just that it can move around more quickly from person to person. There's the Lambda variant, and there's others that are being studied. And this is being watched very, very carefully, really around the world and not just in the U.S. And I think, you know, we're just we can't let up on that. It's called surveillance, because we have to make sure we understand what's out there and what we need to do about it. By the way, we're lucky so far that the vaccines that are out there and available are pretty effective against really all the known strains that are problematic, which is a really good thing, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. I'm so happy to hear that. I was concerned early on, as I think we all were, but it certainly turned out that way. So it's great to know. Shelley Engdahl asks, does the mRNA vaccines have the same risk to someone with Guillain-Barré syndrome
as the flu vaccine? Yeah, Guillain-Barré.
Yeah, I completely botched that then.
No, that's fine.
Guillain-Barré. Okay.
Yeah. Guillain-Barré.
Yeah.
It's a little French thing. You have to understand.
All right. Gotcha.
So Guillain-Barré is it's a neurologic illness that, where the nerves are actually affected by the virus, and it can be serious. It can cause, paralysis of various nerves, including those that control respirations, but it's very, very rare with the vaccines. It happens, it's like the myocarditis, the heart inflammation thing that we've heard about.
Yeah.
These are extremely rare complications. And under all circumstances, you are so much worse off if you get the disease than if you get the vaccine. In other words, the chances of getting something really horrible are far worse for the unvaccinated person who actually catches COVID-19, than is the case for the any complications from the vaccine.
Right on. Salvatore Aversa asks, when can we expect that the vaccine will be available for babies? I have a one-year-old and the wait has been excruciating. I can't even imagine. Those of you with kids, unbelievable the nightmare that must be.
Right. Well, for the time being, as you well know, Bob, we're dealing with 5 to 11-year-olds who are now eligible. Mm-hmm. And we're going to try to get as many of those young kids vaccinated as soon as we can. Kids younger than 5. And by the way, they're working on figuring out the dosage for and the safety of the vaccine in babies and toddlers. But I still think we're some months away from that actually happening. Mm-hmm. But I know it is nerve-wracking, because you want to make sure that your children are protected from whatever they have to be protected from. And I guess there's a lot of us that wish they'd just hurry up and get this out there. So, but it's going to be some months still.
Okay. Anna O'Brien says, I am vaccinated. My booster is due December 21st. Do I have to wait the full 6 months? Also, once I get the booster, do I wait 2 weeks before it is effective? So a couple of good questions in there for you, Doctor.
There's a certain arbitrariness, Bob, about the 6 month period.
Yeah.
Because, this is it's all relative. So we know that by 6 months, a lot of people's immune levels are waning. They're just dropping. Are they dropping to a point where you're more susceptible? We're not exactly sure. But at 6 months, and this is a pretty arbitrarily defined interval, it's time to start thinking about it.
Yeah.
Could you get it at 4 months? You certainly could. There's no harm in it. But if you still have effective immune response at 4 months, why not wait as long as you're still protected, and then get the vaccine at 6 months or 7 months, something like that. But ultimately, we all need to get this booster shot, as we said earlier. And, I think it's going to be the way we do things to keep ourselves protected as long as possible.
Did
I answer her question?
Yeah, I think so. But the second part of the question was a pretty good one. I got this question quite a bit. Is there still that 2-week incubation period after the booster, the same sort of thing that we experienced with the initial vaccinations?
Right. So 2 to 3 weeks is sort of the maximum. You'll get the maximum boost, probably. If it's 12 days, you'll still have a boost. But I think a lot of these time intervals are not based on a lot of hard research, but it's a compilation of what we know about how the immune system works and what we're actually seeing in practice. And I think the 2-week thing is a good mark to know that you're fully safe. But, you know, if you had to go on a trip and it was, like I said, 12 days as opposed to 14 days, I don't think there's going to be much difference.
Okay, sounds good. Because I got my booster 12 days before Thanksgiving Day. So I think I'm still in the window.
Now that I know, I'd like to retract my Thanksgiving invitation that we sent to you. It's
okay. All right. Well, never mind then. I was going to bring this. I was going to bring lots of
damn turkey. You know?
I was going to bring the booze, but if you don't want that, I'll stay home. Mind. Damn it.
You know, I take back what I said. In fact, if you want to come on Wednesday, the doors will be open.
Sounds good. Just two more quick questions. I know you got to run.
Sure.
James Johnson asks, Aaron Rodgers mentioned being allergic to the vaccines. I'd like to hear the doctor's thoughts about allergies to the vaccines.
Can I first tell you my thoughts about Aaron Rodgers?
Absolutely.
An ignorant, dangerous son of a bitch who has done God knows what damage in terms of promulgating this BS that he's gotten from, you know, the biggest purveyors of BS on the planet when it comes to this stuff.
Yep.
I think he should have been fired personally. Mm-hmm. Now, you had a question actually. Yeah. Also, did you? There was a question there.
It was about allergies to the vaccines. Is that a thing? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, some people, it's very rare, but there are certain ingredients in a vaccine that can cause a very serious allergic reaction. Mm-hmm. But if you have no history of significant allergies, I'm talking about the kind of allergies that would require you to carry on an EpiPen, you know, where you'd have to give yourself a shot to start be able to breathe. If it's, you know, if you just have a milk allergy or some other kind of general pollen allergy, that is not relevant to keeping from getting the vaccine.
Okay, gotcha. Timothy O'Neill, this will be the last question from our listeners. Timothy O'Neill writes, when will the antibody test kits be available so people can tell when their antibodies are getting low and that they need a new booster? Is that even a thing that they're developing?
Yeah. Let me talk about that. I'm disappointed that he didn't want to talk some more about Mr. Rogers there, Aaron Rodgers. But okay, so I'm over it now. Yeah. Okay, so let's move on to the actual question he asked.
Yeah.
There won't be anytime soon a reliable home use or rapid testing for antibodies. And part of it is it's tricky. There's a particular kind of antibody that we need to be looking for. It's not something that I would see happening in the consumer market anytime soon. And plus, like I said earlier, Bob, there's no way we don't know how to interpret the numbers even. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a ways off.
I see. You know what? This is I said two more questions. I've got one more quick one for you,
please.
Doctor.
Sure.
And this is from Mike Espinoza. I think this is important because of Thanksgiving around the corner. Regarding eating indoors at restaurants, is there a point to requiring masks to enter and move around the restaurant, but allowing it to be removed once at the table? I've found that to be an interesting dichotomy there. I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, you know, I have the same feeling. So first of all, more and more restaurants are now asking for proof of vaccination to go in. So if I'm walking into a restaurant and I know that everybody's been vaccinated, including the staff as well as the guests, mm-hmm. I'm feeling already pretty good about it. If I see that they're not jamming the tables together like in the old days and there was some spacing there, I'm feeling better. If I'm seeing other people with masks on until they get seated and start, you know, sipping on water or their drinks or getting their appetizers, we're comfortable. Let's say Karen and I are comfortable if all of those things are in place. For a variety of reasons, maybe symbolically, I'm not sure, but we wear the mask until we get seated at the table. Mm-hmm. Does that do anything specifically? I don't know, but I think it's a message that we're still in it, that we're still trying to be careful. Mm-hmm. And I am I am in favor, and that you're walking around, you're hanging around, you know, waiting for the maitre d' to seat you. I think it's just fair to other patrons to, you know, wear the mask and take it off when you sit down.
That's so smart, because I think we live in a monkey see, monkey do society, Dr. Redletter. And I think the more of us setting a good example out in public, the more people are going to be inclined to do those sorts of things. I mean, peer pressure is real. Fear of missing out is real.
It is really real, Bob.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, completely agree.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, the books are called The Future of Us and Americans at Risk. You can see Dr. Redletter on MSNBC and especially on The Stephanie Miller Show every Thursday. And of course, you can follow Dr. Redletter on Twitter at Irwin Redletter MD, link in the description. Thank you so much for chatting with me today, and thank you for doing what you do. I think I speak for thousands when I say your contributions have been literally life-saving. Thank you, thank you, thank you, doctor.
Well, thank you so much for saying that and for allowing me to have some time with you, Bob. It's been a pleasure. It went very fast. And yes. Really, to all your listeners, I think this is a time when having good information by people who care and having these great questions to be, aired and answered is a wonderful thing. Maybe we'll do it again sometime.
Absolutely. I can't wait for that. Thank you again, doctor. Okay. Really appreciate it. And we'll talk to you
soon.
Bye,
Bob. Thank you.
Bye-bye.